Welcome to the Crazy Wisdom Podcast. This is a special series called Stuart Squared, where me and my father, Stuart Alsop II, I'm Stuart Alsop III, where both me and my father interview people from his legendary past as a journalist in the early PC computing industry, and then how he transitioned into a venture capitalist right before the mobile revolution. And then, of course, we'll also talk about how the rise of the internet flavored the entire consciousness of the world and is now taken over in this way that nobody expected back then, although I'm sure they had some thoughts about it. And then we're going to go into today and figure out, you know, how can we navigate this AI revolution as AI sort of promises to fulfill what the early tinkerers in the homebrew club talked about in terms of the rise of personal agency through technology. And one of my insights in AI is that this is a very, very powerful technology, not to automate, because it's, I mean, automate, yes, it will definitely automate things, but the past 50 years of automation in that early personal computing were very deterministic, and this AI is probabilistic, meaning that it's not reproducible. And so it takes a whole other way of thinking about it, but it actually improves your personal agency if you think about it in what I think is the right way. So I hope you enjoy this show. We'll be bringing on a lot of interesting people. We've already had Donna Dubinsky on the first episode and Joe Schoendorf today. And we have some very, very special guests coming up soon. So tune in and find us on iTunes, Spotify. Give us a review if you really like it. You can find us by searching for Crazy Wisdom, which is also my personal channel where I go into things such as the early rise of personal computing, but also many other things. So go and subscribe and leave us a review. Thank you so much. Welcome to the Crazy Wisdom Podcast special series, Stuart Squared, where me and my father interview people from his history as a journalist in the 1980s, 1990s, and early 2000s as the rise of personal computing, the internet, and mobile started to revolutionize the world. And we're going to try to draw lessons from that period and apply them to today and discover what's new. And welcome to the show is Joe Schoendorf. And I'll let my dad go into more detail about exactly where you guys met. Welcome to the show.
So a critical thing about Joe Schoendorf is he's the guy that told me to become a venture capitalist. And I remember this very distinctly, and I don't know if Joe does, but we were standing around at a cocktail party for an event that I created. And he said, "So how are you doing?" This is like Sunday night, and nothing's really happened yet. And I was just feeling honest at the time, and I said, "Well, I'm incredibly bored." And so he responded and said, "Well, you should become a venture capitalist, and I happen to work for a firm that might be interested in employing you." And so that was 1995, and the result of that was I became a VC in 1996. But I've known Joe, we'll get into this. But the first time I met Joe was at Ben Rosen's retirement party at from PC Forum. Ben Rosen was a guy who started really the first conference in the computer industry called PC Forum. And so I met Joe the year that Ben retired after running the conference for, I don't know, 10, 15 years, and turned it over to a lady named Esther Dyson. But we were sitting around at dinner, and I was sitting next to Joe, and he handed me a business card. He was working for Apple at the time. And his business card said he was the manager of markets marketing. I remember this distinctly because I couldn't figure out for the life of me what the manager of markets marketing would do. And so maybe we'll start there. Well, actually, no, I should mention that shortly after getting Joe's card, Phyllis Diller popped out of the cake. I hope you remember that, Joe, because that was pretty memorable to have Phyllis Diller pop out of a cake.
And who is Phyllis Diller?
Who's Phyllis Diller? Oh my God. Phyllis Diller.
Oh my God.
An entertainer, singer, actress, who, when she popped out of the cake, was probably 70 already. and not very good looking. So you'd expect some
Okay, got
gorgeous
it.
woman to pop out of the
That's
cake.
hilarious.
And there was the whole funny thing was it was Phyllis Diller. It's like,
She was a woman, Don Rickles.
Yeah, there you go. Do you know who Don Rickles is?
It's familiar, but I don't. I'm looking it up. Yes, I do know who Don Rickles is. Yes, yeah.
He specialized in insult humor. It doesn't matter who you were, he could take you down. Yeah. And Phyllis was of that genre.
Cool.
So, Joe, that was a hell of an event. And that was my introduction to the computer industry. But so what did the manager of markets marketing do at Apple?
Well, at that point, I think they really changed the title to VP of marketing for the U.S. And I took that job. It's interesting. I had just sold my company, and we had merged Ungerman Bass and Industrial Networking, of which I was the CEO. And I had orchestrated a sale of the combined companies to Jimmy Tribig. At
Tandem Computers, yeah.
And, you know, at that point, Ungerman Bass was the majority owner of my company. General Electric had the second biggest piece. But Ungerman Bass was the first company. I mean, this is actually important stuff. I was with Charlie Bass the other day. I think, correct me, Stuart, but about 1978, there was a Super Bowl ad that introduced the concept of Ethernet.
Ooh.
And it was Intel and Digital Equipment and Xerox. Yeah. Xerox invented Ethernet. DEC was in the Super Bowl. This is a Super Bowl ad. We've just had Super Bowl.
Yeah, I know. We just had
And they Super were Bowl. Showing this plug coming into the wall. And this was going to be the new thing for how the world connected. 1978.
Yeah.
And at that point, Charlie and Ralph worked for Zilog and were inventing the Z80 with Frederic Fajin, which is sort of the beginning of microprocessors and the comm industry. And Charlie said, we can name that chip and get an Ethernet chip out faster than Intel. And they did. They built a gate array, and they had the world's, what I think was the first deliverable Ethernet that connected two computers by this new protocol. And so that started Ungerman Bass.
Yeah.
So
I remember, I'm rolling back a little bit, and I only know this by reference, but as you know, you invited me and my wife at the time to the 30th champagne party. And my impression was that you were working at Hewlett-Packard and were one of the small group of people that got Hewlett-Packard, and I may have all this wrong, got Hewlett-Packard into the computer business. And it was in that environment where you started what became the champagne party.
Well, you know, you talk about luck, Stuart. I graduated from Purdue University in 1966, and I had a double E degree. Yeah. And I remember one day I was in this lab that had really great equipment, which was different than most college labs. This was really high-end, wonderful microwave measuring equipment. And I was commenting to my lab partner about how good this lab equipment was we had. And he said, well, this is made by HP. They're a really good instrument company. Yep. And by the way, they're going to be on campus next week interviewing. And so I was just in the beginning of looking for a job. I went over and signed up. And I had taken two courses in what was a brand new field called digital computing. And we did logic maps and Carnot maps. I mean, this was day zero of digital logic. And HP said, well, we're going to introduce a computer next year. And we are looking for people that have some background. Now, two courses is some background.
Yeah, it is.
And I joined a company in June of 66. We introduced our first computer in November of 66. I worked for a young marketing manager by the name of Tom Perkins.
Tom Perkins, Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield,
Yeah.
and Byers.
Ten, 10 years before Kleiner Perkins got started, Tom was my
Wow.
was running marketing. And we had to figure out, as an instrument company, HP was a $200 million instrument company.
Huge,
And I
yeah.
joined, and I was in the computer business, not really knowing what that was, but we were kind of figuring it out step by step. And I stayed there 18 years and grew it to an $8 billion business from zero. And, then they went on and bought things and became a $100 billion company. But Tom Perkins and Jimmy Tribig was there. That's where, when Tom decided to be a venture capitalist, he had two first deals. One was Jimmy, and he started Tandem, and the other was Genentech. Not bad for two first deals. And he became the master of Silicon Valley venture capital.
Yeah, he did. He
So
did. I've got a question. What separates an instrument company from a computer company? And then what was that like to see that transition? Like what's the difference between making instruments and what kind of instruments? And then what's the difference between making those and computers?
Well, we measured everything. I mean, Hewlett's basic, Bill Hewlett. I was thinking about this the other day. I'm probably one of the luckiest people from a career point of view, because I got to work for HP when Bill and Dave were running the company on a
Ooh,
daily
interesting.
basis.
Wow.
And Hewlett had a very simple expression about measurement. He said, if you can't measure it, you can't understand it. He invented the basic at Stanford. He invented the basic first audio oscillator. And the first customer for HP was actually Walt Disney, who was building the first cartoon. I think it was called Fantasia. And they needed this to make the soundtrack work. So this was way back at, square zero for movies. The computer business was totally different. The policies, the rules, the speed at which it moved. HP owned the instrument market. They owned 80% of any class they were in. Voltmeters, spectrum analyzers, you name it. They had the Cadillac and the best product, and it worked. Our biggest fight in instruments was with Scopes, and that was with Tektronix. The instrument people were a total, or the computer people were a totally different mindset. And we went through a whole generation of moving our best instrument general managers into computers, and they all failed because the speed of the business, when you don't dominate a business, and at that point, DEC was just introducing the PDP-8. They were kind of the leaders in this new thing called mini computers. And the speed of that market was totally different than the speed of an instrument market, meaning how fast did the products change and what you had to get orders.
And is that because of the semiconductor? Is it because of something having to do with the semiconductor?
It was some of all of everything.
All of it. All right. Interesting.
But you had this whole thing called computers, where you then had what's the hardware, what's the software, what's an operating system, what languages do you work? And we were kind of figuring that out. Fortran and BASIC and COBOL, that was what we used, an assembly language. I was sitting thinking the other day, I downloaded the new Mac operating system. And I think it was something like, what a minute, n hundreds of gigabytes of OS, Mac OS, the latest
Just the
version.
code, yeah.
And my wife, who was at HP, she was the lead engineering manager for HP's real-time operating system. That had to run on a 16K. That's 1,000 under M, which is 1,000 under G, had to run on a 16K computer and was written in assembly language and had to have room left for ops. So the world of those days and the world of today are they just have no intersection.
So Now, where did you started a company and it became part of Ungerman Bass. What was that company?
Ungerman Bass owned they owned Ethernet, and there was this new technology called MAP, which was a broadband 10 megabit system. And unlike Ethernet, there wasn't the uncertainty, and it became the standard that manufacturing companies were going to manage automated production, controlling
Wow.
robots to do painting and welding and all of that. And GM and a number of people put the technology together. We built the first chip that worked. And my job was to find, I was a CEO, but I
Right.
was also the chief sales officer. And so I had to close our first customer, IBM, General Motors. I actually sold the chip to Intel because we had a chip that did MAP and they hadn't been able to build one that worked. Because broadband was, MAP was two things. It was a chip, but it was also a broadband modem. And broadband modems were radios, and that wasn't in Intel's wheelhouse. So it was a different world, but we made it work. We sold a whole bunch of systems to big manufacturing companies. And then I got sucked into kind of running the parent company. And then we came under attack and we ended up selling the whole thing. Answering your first question, at that point, Scully called because history, John had just fired Steve Jobs. And when he fired Steve, Bill Campbell, the coach, went to quit. And he said, if Steve's not here, I'm not going to work here anymore. John said, well, I need you. And so he created a company, Stuart, that you will remember called Claris.
I do.
That was the Apple software company to compete
Software
with
company.
Microsoft. They had all their spreadsheet, Word, Paint, Draw, or whatever they called it. And they made Bill the CEO of Claris and let it be an independent company. And then Bill, Scully said, look, I need a VP of marketing. And Bill identified two people who could do it. One was me, and the other was Ed Zander. And if you really want to get into history, on alternate Saturdays, I was either interviewing at Sun to take over the VP of marketing job, or with Scully and Boesenberg and Jean-Louis Gasset to be the VP of marketing at Apple. And Xander was doing alternate weeks. I knew him, and he ended up doing Sun. I ended up doing Apple. And it was a fun thing to do, but it was, in brutal candor, one of the most disorganized companies I've ever been around,
Was
which is.
Claris?
No.
Claris was.
Well, I mean, Apple at that point, Scully was running it. Jean-Louis Gasset, being blunt now, was a great guy. He was a marketing guy who was now finding himself as VP of engineering. And
I
it
first
didn't.
met Jean-Louis in France because he started out as president of Apple France, and
Well, and before that, he was responsible for two things. He was the chief calculator salesman for the handheld calculators at HP, which is where I met him. And then, if you remember, Exxon decided to get into the computer business. And he was the VP of marketing for Exxon computers.
So there's an interesting thread right there. So when a large entrant from a different industry or even in the same industry tries to innovate against a newbie or a new entry, what does it feel like to have that huge like entry into something like Exxon into the field and then not have it work out? Because I imagine that it didn't work out with Exxon, right?
Not. And it did not work out pretty quickly.
If I look at my life, which goes back to mainframes to mini computers, that was the first transition. The incumbent never wins.
Ever. That's still
Every
true
time
today.
we have a platform change, we have a new winner. So we platform changed from mainframes to minis, and you had the rise of two companies, an instrument company called HP and a company started in Massachusetts called Digital Equipment Company.
Yeah.
And Digital Equipment Company made it to the front page of Business Week with Ken Olson's picture. Are they the next IBM?
Yeah.
That went to servers. And, you know, IBM and HP weren't really players. You had the Suns and the Apollos that dominated that market. And then we went to personal computers. Hello, Apple. Hello, Michael Dell.
Or even Commodore and Radio Shack.
I shouldn't say this, but I remember interviewing John Akers in when the Mac came out, or when the Apple II came out. And I was talking to him about something, and he said to me, we really see no threat to the IBM Corporation from these personal computers. And that's the story of incumbents never get the transition. And my whole life, I mean, now 50 years, every time there's a major transition, internet, you pick a whole new set of players, cloud, hello, Salesforce.
Yeah.
So
let's bring that up to date, Joe, because we're all watching this AI stuff happen. And of course, OpenAI is this new company that showed up unbeknownst to most of us. And then Microsoft, which is, you know, a legacy company from a prior generation, seems to like be right on top of AI and is making Google look like the legacy company. Are you watching this?
Google, unfortunately, has become the new IBM.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, they have become the new IBM because they started playing defense, and you don't win a game by playing prevent defense.
Yeah.
And I mean, they owned AI, but let me say this. With AI, we are going to have a new set of winners.
Yeah.
That we do not know who they are. And I wanted to take a minute to tell you why I think that's true. If you look at the key to figuring out what's going to happen is where the smart young people go to work. And 20 years ago, they came out, they wanted to work for an Apple or an Oracle or a Sun or whatever the hot company was. Now they want to work for a startup. And they're looking today for what are the hot AI startups. We're spending, I'm told, $1 billion a quarter on AI investments in American venture capital.
Mm.
And the center point for that is still Silicon Valley and San Francisco. Mark Benioff did an X post the other day when he talked about the coming shortage of office space in San Francisco based on all the new AI startups that were coming in, where we've had this vacuum of all this free offices in the city for the last 3 or 4 years, that's beginning to change. So I don't know who, my job as a venture capitalist is to hopefully intersect one of these people, but it isn't going to be an incumbent unless the rules of the last 50 years change, and I don't see how they will.
And I'd like to understand, because we've talked a lot about like early instruments, computers, semiconductors, and then we've jumped into AI. I would love to understand, like, in the 1980s and the 1990s, what exactly happened to venture capital to make it such a new thing in the realm of technology and then also become such a dominant thing? And like, what was it like to be part of that?
Well, Accel started in 1984, which is about when most of the venture guys get going. That was the first boom that really happened. Kleiner Perkins had been there, and two or three, maybe Sequoia, but a whole batch got started in the mid 80s, and there was a big market up. And it really was the time that venture capital kind of came into its own, at the same time that people who had worked for big established companies were saying, I want to go start something new. And the two just came together. You know, Accel started in late 84, early 85, more David Dell. you can run through, you know, 20 yeah. companies that got started in that time frame. And it was just sort of the market was ready with technology, mostly driven around the advent of the microprocessor. Mm-hmm. Most of the startups that were really big then used this brand new thing called a microprocessor, Z80, and the Intel 8008, you know. Yeah. And that created this whole plethora of companies. And then you got into it, then it got serious because now it's 1987. And this group in Stanford says, well, I think how I know how networks ought to work. Mm. And a little company called Cisco got started.
Yeah. And
you just go through the history of that. And then you got the next big move came. Here's this guy called Mark Andreessen at the University of Illinois. And he's invented this thing called a browser.
Yeah.
And he's going to start a company called Netscape.
Yeah, that was 94. I think
94, and they've gotten a guy named Jim Barksdale from FedEx to join.
Yeah.
And Kleiner Perkins is all over it with Sequoia financing Netscape. So it just started a balloon, which has gotten bigger and bigger every year since then.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. We see patterns now. This is part of what's been fun, I think, to be early in the business is. Or early enough that you wouldn't necessarily have seen patterns. IBM leading the Digital Equipment Corporation was, you know, first of all, it took for a long time compared to what we're used to. But now we can see patterns, like we can see these waves happen and see how fast they go, and they go faster and faster. And that's part of the, at least for me, the fun part of having been involved fairly early. I mean, I came way after you did, Joe.
Well, I don't think that far, but I won't be this in this blog. So do you know why Silicon Valley is based where it is?
Oh, I just read about that. Because Shockley invented
absolutely the, right.
Yeah. And I've just read the book about Shockley and, you know,
when I was
at boy, HP, did that guy flip out. It's
wait, well, how so? Wait, how so?
Well, let me tell you about it because he was my professor.
Okay.
When I was at HP, I had a AA degree from Purdue, and they had this sign up at Stanford. I was working in Palo Alto, and you can take two classes a week, and we'd like you to get your master's in electrical engineering. So I signed up for that, and I'm at Stanford. And there's this professor I signed up for this class, and it's William Shockley.
Yeah.
And I will say to you without any hesitation, I actually don't write many letters, but I wrote this professor letter, said it was the best teaching experience I'd ever had. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you about that separately. But as we got to know him, I asked him one day, because he'd come out, just for the history, he'd come out of Bell Labs having won the Nobel Prize for the transistor. AT&T in their infinite wisdom did not pursue development of the transistor as a business. He started Shockley Transistor. He hired a couple of people. He hired 12 people who had PhDs in solid state physics. One was Eugene Kleiner
of
the Kleiner Perkins. Another was a young fellow called Gordon Moore who had the future. And he had 12 people of that caliber. He was about the worst manager there ever was. One day, they all quit.
They drove them all out.
En masse, and they all went to Fairchild. And he tried to use the police and the courts and everything to keep it from happening. But they're at Fairchild, and that begot then 2 years later, Gordon Moore and his team left and started this young company called Intel. I asked... One day I was with Professor Shockley and I said, why did you come to Palo Alto to start Shockley Transistor? Because that was, you know, the beginning of the Silicon part of Silicon Valley. You know, he said, my mom lived here.
His mother, exactly. That's what this book was about.
I needed to come and be with her. And I said, do you mean if your mom had lived in Keokuk, Iowa, That's where Silicon Valley would be. And he said, I suspect so. So that's a true story.
It is a true story. There's a whole book.
I heard it from his mouth. My mom was sick. I came to Palo Alto. We built the first transistor company, i.e. the first silicon in Silicon Valley.
No, that was great. That a lot of the history of William B. Shockley is based on the letters he wrote to his mom. And because, you know, back then people actually wrote letters and mailed them. And we still have them.
He got into big trouble during a professorship at Stanford because he'd gotten interested in the field of eugenics. And he had decided and started publishing articles about the inferiority of race on IQ based on studies he'd done.
Statistical analysis,
And what that did is unleash the academic community on him. And I remember at one point there was a guy named Joshua Lederberg who had won a Nobel Prize, who basically said to him, being candid, you have no effing business commenting on social issues. You're an engineer. And they literally blackballed him academically.
Was that in the 1960s? Or when was that?
I took my class from him in the 67, 68 timeframe. And that was when he was being literally hung on a cross because he had turned from this Nobel Prize winning physicist who invented the transistor to a commentator on what he thought were social issues. And the academic community violently reacted.
Yeah, well, it wasn't just the academic community. He was a pauper when he passed. I mean, he's still living in his mother's house in Palo Alto.
Really? I didn't know that.
He was rejected.
In the late 1960s, that must have been really interesting time because I've been doing a lot of research on the early personal computing industry, and there seems to be a direct correlation between what was happening in the San Francisco and Portola Valley with the hippies to the personal computing industry with the homebrew. Well, eventually got into homebrew, but really about Stuart Brand. Joe, what's your take on like that relationship between that consciousness revolution in the Bay Area and then how it impacted, if at all, the computer industry?
There is a phenomenal book, Stuart. I think you know John Markoff well. What the church mouse heard, or something like that.
Stuart, you told me about it. So.
Yeah, no, I've been reading it. I've been reading the biography. Well, I don't know if it's the same one, but I've been reading a biography on Stuart Brand by John Markoff.
Well, so Markoff wrote this series, this book about the whole advent of Stuart Brand and the people around him and the LSD and the whole culture of, you know, the mouse got invented in 69 at SRI. It could move a cursor on an IBM 370, you know, from one level of text down one level to the next level of text. But it took an IBM 370 to run it. So now you had the mouse. And it was just the whole book just talks about the progression of how we finally ended up with a, quote, personal computer.
What the Dormouse Said, How the 60s Counterculture Shaped the Personal Computer Industry.
And that is a very accurate book based on, I grew up with a lot of the people. I knew not all of them, but a large number socially. I mean, John does good work, and that book kind of says, this is how it all got started.
Yeah, he does do good work. He worked for me at InfoWorld when I first moved to California in 1983. And he resigned in protest. He and Paul Freiberger and Michael Swain all stood up in a staff meeting and said, you're making us work too hard. We're leaving.
Really?
I walked out of the room. And I was like, I was a surprise. I guess I'm could be clueless, but that's part of what taught me I shouldn't be a manager.
Okay, so I would let we got about 15 more minutes, and I would love to understand more like stories from either of you about like funny things that happened between you, or ridiculous things, or anything that really sparks out like about wild stuff that nobody would ever read about.
Before we do that, let me share with you some recent thinking I've had. And I kind of picked this one up last year at TED. But the question is, what's really changed in Silicon Valley dramatically in the 50 years I've been there? And I would tell you there are two things. When I first got into venture capital, or when I first became a CEO, most CEOs of startups were in their late 30s or 40s. And that is now cut in half. When we
Beautiful.
gave Mark Zuckerberg his money, we were lead investors in the first round at
We
Facebook, the
were,
East. He was 18 years old. He had no resume. Where have you worked? I haven't. Who've you managed? I haven't. But give me $10 million and you can have X percent of this. And we did it. But if you look, all of the people today, it's very seldom we see a CEO whose age isn't a two in the first digit, in the prime digit. So that's a huge change. The second thing that's even more important, and I think it's going to be the driver going forward, is the speed of which new technologies emerge. And I heard a talk last year at TED that defined why that was happening. And if you think about what the talk said, it's one of these things where somebody tells you say, yeah, that's self-evident. But what we've been doing for 50 years is inventing tools. The more tools you invent, the easier it is to invent the next thing because you have more tools to do it.
To do the invention, yeah.
And so we've just got this tremendous set of tools. AI being the latest, greatest, and all it's going to do is shorten the time between next major breakthroughs.
Yeah.
And so for the next 20 or 30 years, the speed of change is going to continue to increase.
So, Joe, one of the things I have to ask you about is because my part of my experience of moving from Boston to Silicon Valley to be editor of InfoWall was that there was an AI revolution going on then, and there were a bunch of companies in both Silicon Valley and Boston that were inventing AI, and that was 40 years ago.
We did one of them.
You did one of them.
It was called IntelliCorp.
And IntelliCorp, which was in Boston or
And that
Massachusetts.
was Casey Branscum, if you remember Casey.
Yeah, I do.
Casey's father was the CTO at IBM. And Casey started IntelliCorp, which we invested in. And if you take that story to the end. I remember maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I was having lunch with Eric Schmidt. And he said to me, I'm going over to Stanford tomorrow to meet with the AI team. Do you want to come? And I'd known Eric for, Nancy, my wife worked for him at Sun.
Yeah.
And I said, all right, we'll go. And we go over there. Mark Andreessen's there. I'm there. Eric, three or four other people. And I asked the professor who'd been there at the time of IntelliCorp, he's a very senior old guy. And he said, when you did IntelliCorp, there were four universities in America that had AI in their curriculum. And he said, now there are four that don't.
That's great.
And
That's great.
that's,
Yeah. How
and
did
if you take that and you take it with what the single biggest change was, which made AI happen. It was the cloud. Why was it the cloud? It's the first time we have all digital information that's retrievable in an efficient way so that training can occur.
Yeah.
Until you had the cloud, there was no efficient process for training for the current generation of AI that needs to be trained and taught what it's going to do.
And
Yeah. So
is that
the
what
fact that
in
all universities now have an advanced program or some semblance thereof
yeah.
locked in with the cloud, you know, net result is where we are.
That's super interesting. And did IntelliCorp fail because of that specific problem?
It succeeded in the sense that I think, and I got to go look it up, but I think we got our money back. It was a very focused, it wasn't in no way general purpose.
Yep.
It was aimed at a vertical app in biology. And in that vertical app, it was okay.
Yep.
But lost, it was the Model A of a car that still needed a crank to start it, et cetera, et cetera. And had no expansion capabilities.
That's really interesting. So how do you end up at Excel?
Well, that's interesting. So when I left HP, when I turned 40, because I decided I'd taken the first time in my life, I'd taken 3 weeks off to celebrate my 40th birthday. And I had sort of made a decision that I was never going to be the CEO of HP. And really didn't want to be in my heart of hearts, you know, that administrative level I didn't want to do. And I said, the only thing I've got to do is go find a job that I really like. And while I was on vacation, my boss quit. That was Ed McCracken. And HP senior managers did not ever leave the company. But Ed went to this new startup as CEO called Silicon Graphics. And that was the day in which Silicon Graphics was going to be the new digital TV and digital everything. And it turns out that Ungerman Bass was doing a search for the CEO for this joint venture with GE to do this new technology. And the same search guy that had taken McCracken out of HP was hired by Ungerman Bass. And obviously, search guy calls McCracken and said, who at HP would be interested in this kind of job? And McCracken said, well, one of my guys, Schoendorf, this sounds like a natural for him. Call him. I come back from vacation. I get a call. And I went over and met Ralph, and it just clicked. Yeah. I go to work. I do the job. I get invited to the board to do a pitch on how we're doing. And there's a guy on the board called Jim Schwartz, who was the founding partner of Accel.
Yeah.
And there's the egg that, you know, started it all. After I left and I sold the company, Jim said, well, you want to come join us? And I said, you know, I don't know if I want to be a venture capitalist. And he said, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, you sort of need an office. Why don't you come up on Mondays and sit with us? And I did. And I would go up on Mondays and I'd listen to new guys come in asking for money.
Yeah.
And that was 38 years ago.
Yeah. Are you still going up on Mondays?
No. Arthur and Jim and I made a conscious decision to get out of the way.
Yeah.
Because most first generation firms died. Because the founders wouldn't relinquish,
wouldn't let go.
The pay package and wouldn't let go. And the number that died because of that. So Jim and Arthur both said, we just had our 40th anniversary last November.
You did.
And Arthur both said, we are going to put in a new generation of leaders. We're now in our third generation. And we're going to get a little carry, but the overwhelming majority of it goes to the new team.
Yeah.
So there's no need for anybody to do anything but continue to build the firm.
So I have to ask, and I'll do this as a wrap up, was the decision to invest in Facebook, as we call it in the venture business, controversial? Or did everybody go, oh yeah, we got to do this?
Oh, there was controversy, but you remember at that point it had a lot of angel money. And so we had some indication of what was going on. And let me tell you that we had a company called Comscore that we had done. And Comscore was sort of the system that let you know where traffic was on the internet and what was going on.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden we see this thing called Facebook, where the traffic increase is a vertical line.
Yeah.
And so it got our attention. One of our young techs got it.
Yeah.
And then the question was, let's bird dog it. And success has many fathers. Our firm has 10 guys who did it.
Yeah.
The book that got written, Power Shift or so, tells the real story about the partner who founded Bird Dogged It. Breyer ended up closing the deal and going on the board.
On the board. Peter Wagner? Do I remember that correctly?
No, it wasn't Wagner. It was Kevin Effersey was really the fellow who founded the deal and ran it. But Breyer came in and took it. He was sort of the senior partner. And yeah, it was controversial because you're given $10 million to a zero sum, you know, no resume.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I met Mark, I said this to my partners, and I think it's in the record. This is a guy who's Bill Gates smart. Those were my exact words.
Yeah.
He exhibited that kind of intelligence that you don't find in that age group.
Generally speaking, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so we did it, and Breyer is a very sophisticated investor, and we had made a deal with Mark that he needed an adult partner that knew how to run a company, and that resulted in us and several other people recruiting Cheryl to come in and be his partner. And I think Mark said the perfect thing the other day in an interview he did. He says, "Where Cheryl treated me like a good parent."
Meaning Cheryl was the good parent, but
Cheryl was the good parent. Yeah. No, yeah, she
exactly.
She knew what to do, and she
helped. Yeah.
And I can tell you more stories there if we had time about Cheryl and Mark and make them grow up.
Yeah.
We'll do another one.
Story wind us up.
Yeah. So, well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and it was an honor and a pleasure to interview both of you and get some of this access to this beautiful history out there.
Thanks, Joe.
Good. Good. Are we off?
Not quite.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Crazy Wisdom Stuart Squared. And if you did, please go on to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and go ahead and give us a review. Hit the subscribe button and maybe even share it with a friend. This is a really exciting show. I think we're going to go into places that really give a lot of value to those who are listening. So have a great day. Thank you.